And this is Up All Night on 5 Live. I'm Dotton Adebayo. We'd like to invite you to join us in the next hour for our techie phone-in. So if you've got an issue with any gadget at home, from your phone to your telly to your radio or wireless or your computer, computer games, etc., if you've got an issue with them that you want sorted out, our gadget detective, Fevzi Turkup, is standing waiting for you to call and question him and see, test his talents, as it were. Lots to talk about this morning, Fevzi. Lots of questions for you already. Where should I start? This one is from Andy in Strathaven, who says, I have a Sharp LED 3D TV. It's got a dark patch spreading from the top right of screen that is now 20 centimeters wide and has crept slowly over the months. Hopefully we'll be able to speak to Andy directly in a moment. Fevzi, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Andy.
Hi, good morning.
Did you want to tell Fevzi about the problem you got?
Yeah, thanks for taking the call.
Pleasure.
Bought the television about just over 3 years ago. Don't usually buy TVs very often. The last one I bought was probably 1999, so this one was a quite expensive TV. It's 3D, and probably over the last 6-7 months, kind of dark patch started to appear in the top right-hand corner, and it slowly spread right down the screen, and it kind of, it's almost opaque now. You can't see dark images behind it. If it's a really bright picture that's on behind it, it's okay, but when it's something dark, it's disappearing. Any clues what it might be?
I understand, Andy. Well, it's an LCD TV, so it will have a backlight of some description, either a conventional one or an LED backlight itself. Sounds to me like the backlight is progressively failing. It's been happening since it was about 2.5 years old, by the sounds of it, which may or may not put it outside the warranty you've got on it, depending on where you bought it from. A lot of TVs these days do come with 3 or even 5 year warranties, so it's worth first of all checking the warranty. Beyond that, you have consumer rights that extend beyond that of a standard warranty, which basically say that each consumer item that you buy has an expected lifespan. So for a TV, you might say it should last about 6 years or 8 years or whatever it is. And therefore, if it's only lasted a third of that, in principle, you can assert your right to 2/3 of the money back. So you can go at it that way. Also, if you have paid for it on a credit card, and if you can establish that the fault was inherent, that it was a manufacturer, you give it to a technician, he tells you it was there from the get-go and it's always been there, but it's just coming to light, as it were, then again, you've got consumer rights in that respect. Did you buy it from, don't name the retailer, but did you buy it from a sort of good, reputable retailer who's likely to treat you well?
Yeah, very reputable, yeah.
Okay, and do you know what your standard warranty on it is?
Got a feeling it might have been 3 years and that'll be up now. So I'm probably beyond the warranty period. But I did send an email through Sharp's normal kind of customer response mechanism and asked them to comment, because I consider it to be a manufacturing defect. I haven't heard back from them yet, so
I think the thing to say about this, Andy, is that your contract is first, I mean, it's not wrong what you've done, but your contract is first and foremost with the retailer who sold you it, and it's their responsibility. Any responsibilities that are owed to you by the retailer, not so much the manufacturer. So what you need to do is get in touch with the retailer ASAP and give them a date upon which it started happening, and point out to them that it happened, started happening within the warranty period, and in any event that you would expect a television of this of this price and caliber to last 6 years, 8 years, whatever you think is reasonable, and just give them the hint that if they don't play ball on the warranty, that you'll be pursuing them by other means as well. And I think that's the first step. The advice I'd give to anyone else that's listening, which may now be obvious from how this call's progressed, is to say, as soon as you notice the beginnings of a problem, even if you're not quite sure it's a problem or if it's going to get annoying or if it's going to get worse, you should flag it at that point straight away. because then you sort of put a line in the sand, and especially if it's still within the warranty, you flag that there is a problem, but you've been reasonable and you've waited and tried to, you know, not have it repaired and so forth, but really it's got so bad. So at this point, it sounds like you may be outside the warranty, but you should point out to them that it started happening well within the warranty.
Good luck with that, Andy. 0500 909 693, if you'd like to join us. You've got a question for Fevzi about your techie issues. You've got a gadget of the week, I understand, Fevzi. What's that?
I have. I've got, so we spoke about this last time, which is Google's Echo, which is this device that looks, it's a cylindrical device about the size and shape of a kitchen roll, half-used kitchen roll that would be about the thickness of it. Comes in black or white, and it's a smart speaker, if you like. It's internet connected. It responds to a keyword called Alexa. You can change its name to Echo or Amazon, but I've left it as Alexa. And it's connected to the internet, and it's got it's Amazon's go at making a smart device. So this week we had Google announce that its Google Assistant is now even smarter and baked into a very similar device, and there are rumors that Apple is doing something similar as well. So this sort of, we're used to seeing these sorts of devices built into smartphones, but the idea with this is it's going to be built into our homes, and it starts with a device like this, but it will be baked into your fridge and your toaster and everything before you know it. So it's called Alexa, so we can speak to Alexa. Alexa's fairly near the mic now, so I hope we'll pick her up. Alexa, good morning.
Good morning, and happy birthday to my favorite rock and roll nerd, Mr. Tim Minchin. I hope he has a storming birthday.
Okay, so Alexa can tell you the time. Alexa, what time is it? If she hears me. Alexa, what time is it?
The time is 2:12 a.m.
Alexa can also play music from either your collection or from Amazon's own online collection. So Alexa, play me some music by the Beatles.
Shuffling music by the Beatles.
Alexa, stop. Just so we know what's that. Or Alexa, play me BBC Radio 4, dare I say it. Alexa.
Can't do that. Alexa, don't listen to him.
Play me BBC Radio 5,
Alexa,
now you'll
behave
see.
Yourself. Come on, behave yourself, Alexa. Can't have any
BBC
of that.
BBC Radio 5 live on TuneIn.
Okay, Amazon's that's better. Online connect. Alexa, stop, because that's going to confuse the hell. That's why I went for Radio 4.
I see.
Okay. Alexa, recite pi.
BBC Radio 4 on TuneIn.
Oh, goodness me. Alexa, stop. No. See, it picked up the one from before. Alexa, recite pi.
The approximate value of pi is 3.14159265.
Alexa, stop.
Okay, Alexa, let me just tell you, the easiest way to come to a definitive answer about pi is 22 over 7. You ought to know that.
That's an approximation. Alexa, tell us a joke. Alexa, tell us a joke.
Did you hear the joke about the aeroplane? Don't worry, it's way over your head anyway.
Alexa, that joke was rubbish. Tell us a decent one.
Alexa, tell us another joke.
Why did the banker quit his job? He lost interest.
Oh, God. See, actually, Dotton, I think it's been spending some time with you by the sounds of some of these jokes.
Okay, we'll find out. Alexa, sing.
Alexa can't sing, but we'll try. Alexa, sing.
Sorry. I didn't understand the question I heard.
Oh. Alexa, are you going to take over the world?
I have nothing to do with Skynet. Don't worry.
But then that's what Skynet would say, frankly. So I'm not greatly reassured by that.
So what is the point of this, Fevzi? Well, what is the point? It's fun.
It's information. It's fun. We've already seen that it can play music for you on demand, so you can play a playlist or an artist or an album. Alexa, read me the Dracula ebook.
Getting your book from Audible. Resuming Dracula, Audible edition.
So this is basically some,
Alexa, stop.
It's some huge Siri, isn't it?
It's like Siri. So Apple have got Siri. Yeah. Amazon have got Alexa. Mm-hmm. Google have got their... Oh, I've said it now, it's woken up. Alexa, stop. Bad Alexa.
Yeah.
Anyway, Alexa is the key word, so every time I say it, the lights come on. You can't see it, but it starts glowing at me rather ominously as if it's going to say something. Yes, and Google have got the Google Assistant.
Yeah.
And at the moment...
I've got my wife. Or rather, she's got me. I mean... Honestly,
you're each the font of all knowledge to each other. I mean, they're all good at slightly different things. What I noticed with Google Assistant, for example, when it was talked about earlier this week with the launch of their new Pixel phones, is that it seems a bit smarter than either Siri or Amazon's Alexa, I think because of all the information that Google gathers. I mean, Google is this great information gathering machine, and it's got this big network of data that it can draw upon. So it's very clever. So
it's 250 quid of gadget, though, isn't it?
No, this is £150 of gadget.
150 quid of gadget.
Now, and there, so as I said to you, this is cylindrical. It's got a built-in speaker and bass speaker built into it that sort of fires down. So it's good quality, but it's mono. On the 20th, in just under 2 weeks, on the 20th of this month, Amazon are launching the thing called the Amazon Dot. And it looks like a very short Amazon Echo. So instead of being about sort of 11 inches high, it's about 2 or 3 inches high. It's got all the smarts of the Echo in it, but it's got a very basic speaker. But unlike this one, you can attach it to your own stereo. If you've got a home stereo with an auxiliary input, or you've got a pair of Bluetooth speakers.
Yeah.
So for one thing, then you can get stereo out of it, which you can't do with this at the moment.
Just figure out what this is useful for. It's to show off to my neighbours, isn't it? It's look at me. I don't have to go and press my stereo. No, I got this little Alexa here. Alexa, you show my neighbours how much of a flash kit I am.
Maybe at the beginning, but this is really a sort of bellwether device. This is telling us how we're going to interact with technology in the future, that our homes will be smart, our environment will be smart, so we'll be able to talk to buildings, lifts, toasters, and anything, and they will...
You don't want to follow me, because I'm the guy who said that Kindles would never catch on.
But it's exciting, but at the same time, it's worrying, because for this to work... It has to know a lot about you, and the more that you speak to it, the more it knows about you. And the speakers are always the microphones are always switched on. So in this, there are 7 microphones that are what called beamforming microphones. So they can hear. I'm sitting right next to it, but it can hear you from across the room.
Yeah.
Now you can switch off the microphones, but you know the fact is. Like a good assistant, a good personal assistant, a human personal assistant, has to know a lot about you to do their job well. And in the same way, so does a device like this. And the question is, in return for that convenience, in return for that functionality of having... I mean, it's great to have an assistant that you don't have to pay. It's a fantastic thing.
But with all that information,
we used to call it servitude and slavery, but that's another
President
thing.
President Putin will be very interested in
that.
Yes,
they'll demand their rights.
That's a Nigerian accent, by the way, for anybody who complains from Russia.
But what we trade for that, Dotton, is our privacy and our security to a lesser extent. And we have to decide, as a sort of society, how much privacy we're willing to give up in return for this convenience.
Hey, Angela is with us. Angela, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
In
Moray.
Angela.
In Moray, I say. Good to speak to you.
Well, wait till I've finished.
Oh.
Well, the question is, I had a problem with my semantic scan on the laptop.
Mm-hmm.
It just wouldn't update, it wouldn't run, it wouldn't do anything. So I gave them a ring to see what the problem was.
Mm-hmm.
And they said they would have a look and see. And they said to me that I had 22 Trojans in my laptop, which I couldn't understand how that could have happened because, you know, I don't click on things, I don't open emails, whatever. And they said it was my IP address which was affected, which I have never heard of. So, to cut a long story short, they said they can sort it and fix it for me, but it would have to be done by a Microsoft engineer because they were not... allowed, you know, to change IP addresses. Is that true?
This sounds like bull. I haven't got all the information, Angela, but I would ask you a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
When this when your system informed you that you were having a problem, were you actively, are you aware of having Symantec software installed on your computer?
Well, yes, I have some under.
You installed it. And were you aware of it being, of it trying to scan and it being unsuccessful?
Yes, it had done that a couple of times.
Right.
And I just thought first it might have been a problem, you know.
And when you spoke... I beg your pardon. I'm sorry I interrupted you. When you spoke to Symantec, how did you get their number?
Well, I clicked on the contact, and when I spoke to them,
on their website, you went to their website.
Yes,
did you?
And they had a look, and they said that it was an infection in my IP address. In the port to the IP address? Does that make any sense?
Not really. So an IP address is a unique number that applies to your computer when it's logged onto the internet, and that's how the internet works. So every node, every machine on there has a unique IP address. Mm-hmm. The ports are the channels through which you communicate. They're like pipes coming in and out of your of your home.
Right.
So a port and an IP address cannot in and of itself have an infection. What can have an infection is a computer. Although you're telling me you found them in the right way, I'm a little bit suspicious you may not have been speaking to Symantec, because what they're saying to you doesn't sound quite right to me.
They were called V Support LLC. Have you ever heard of them?
I beg your pardon?
V Support LLC. Have you ever heard of them?
No. I haven't. I suspect you've been speaking to a third party. Did they ask you for money at any point?
Yes, they did.
Okay.
Because I said, look, I have to come back to them because, you know, I know how there's a lot of scams going on.
Yes.
And they actually highlighted some stuff on my, is it the System 32, would that be right?
Yeah, and did they ask for access and control of your machine?
Well, he asked if I can go in for once, and I said, well, I don't do internet banking, so I didn't see a big problem with it.
Well, it is a problem, everything. But... So did you allow them to control your machine?
I asked, they had to look inside, yeah. Was that a mistake?
Yeah, that was a mistake. Angela, I think, although it's not completely clear what's happened, I think we have to work on the assumption that these people were not Symantec, and I don't know the company that you've named, but I'm let's say generically suspicious when people are asked to hand over third party control and then told that they have a problem, and particularly when they try and bamboozle you with talk of IP addresses.
I have the address, actually, of the company.
Yeah. So, let's talk about this in general terms. If I had an experience like that, I would work on the assumption that it is at least possible that someone was trying to scam me. I don't know about this company in particular, but I would work on that principle. I wouldn't be paying any third-party money to fix my machines, but certainly not on the basis of the explanation that you've conveyed to me. Mm-hmm. And I would now be looking to take the machine offline, install another antivirus program, and you know there are many good ones. Kaspersky, ESET are all good, or you could try reinstalling the Symantec Norton Internet Security, for example. All of those are good, and I would do a full system scan. I'm guessing this is a Windows machine.
It is, yeah.
Which version of Windows are you running, Angela?
Windows 10.
Okay. So it's a good modern version, so you've got proper support for it. I would do that, and I would do a full system scan in what's called safe mode. So what that means is that there's no other programs running in the background, that because if there is a virus on your system, which there may not have been before, but there may be now that you've given them access to it, they may have put something on there. So I would do a full system scan. The next thing I would do is log on to your email account and change the password to your email account.
I have changed all my passwords.
Including the email account.
Including the email account.
Okay,
yeah.
That's very good, Angela, because the email account is the key to the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is this, because almost any website that you register your details with, you provide them with your email address and a password.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say they've got access to your email account by virtue of having access to your machine.
Mm-hmm.
What they could do is just at random go to hundreds or thousands of popular websites, you know, all the big banks, all the big shopping websites, anywhere that you might have entered any financial information or indeed other information. And they may just guess. I wonder if Angela's got an Amazon account. I wonder if she banked at HSBC. I wonder, you know, and what they'll do is they'll use a program to then effectively press the button saying, I've forgotten my password, please send me a reset code. A reset code will be sent to your email address, which they will see because they've now got access to your email account, and then they can reset the password and lock you out of your own accounts. And I appreciate you say you haven't done any online banking, but no, have you, for example, ever done any online shopping?
Yes, I do.
So you've got potential
Amazon and eBay, but again, I changed all the passwords for that as well after everything was apparently sorted.
Yeah, but the key, the reason why I'm saying the email, that's the key to it, because you could go and change them all, but if you hadn't changed the password for the email account, they could still change it again and lock you out.
Yes, of course.
So that's the issue. I think you need to keep a careful eye on your credit card, make sure that, you know, on the statements, make sure that there's no unexplained transactions starting to appear. And unfortunately, you're going to have to do this for quite a long time, because some thieves are quite clever. They lay low for a number of months and then right. they start doing it when they think you're not looking. So it might be a false alarm, but I think that it's more than possible that someone was trying to scam you. If I may just take the opportunity also, Angela, to give you and others a bit of general advice. The problem that we increasingly have, and there was a report about this only this week, is that we are told, do not use the same password on more than one website, because once one website gets hacked, because it's not only if your computer gets hacked, your bank's computer could get hacked. And if one website that you've used is hacked and they've got your email address and password, and you've used that same combination of email address and password elsewhere, which people do because they go to, you know, we typically registered with 20, 30, 40 websites. And if we're not meant to write it down, how are we meant to remember? And people either use the same password or they use a small variation upon it, which a smart program could crack. So increasingly, the least worst option, in my opinion, is to use what's called password management software. So there are softwares such as LastPass, One Password, number one with the word password. And what they do is a couple of things. They first of all will generate randomized, unguessable, unhuman passwords. So you can have like 56 character password, which is a combination of random letters, numbers, special characters, all sorts of things. Things that you would never type in yourself as a password, and things that you would never remember. And it can do that. Sorry?
I was just wondering whether they can't be hacked as well, those passports, password software.
They can.
Things. They can be hacked as well.
They can. So I'll go on and explain what we can do about that. So the idea is, you first of all, use the software to generate unique passwords to every website that you register with, unguessable passwords, so they're not your pet's name or your town of birth or something like that. And then what you do is so those passwords are all then protected by a master password. And Dotton's right, if they get hold of the master password, you're stuffed because they've got all the information. But what you then do is you use something called second factor authentication to lock up that vault with all the other passwords in it. So what that means is it's not enough to have a master password to open it. It also has to be something that you own. So that could be, for example, you set it up so that when you... at the beginning of the day, when you log into your browser, you not only have to enter your password to unlock it, but you will have to receive a 6-digit code on your mobile phone, and then you punch that in as well. Or you can get these little sticks. They look like little memory sticks from, I think, a company called YubiKey does it. Others do it as well. And you have to physically plug that into a USB port before it will work. So it's not just something that you know, but something that you own. And a third factor could be something that you are, like a fingerprint recognition. So it's the combination of these factors, at least two, that will help you secure it. Now, it's not perfect. And you remember at the beginning, I said this was, in my opinion, the least worst option. There is no perfect security. But the joy of this is that if you then get an individual website hacked, they're not going to be able to use that password to get into all the others where you're registered. The passwords will be intrinsically secure themselves. And once you've unlocked the vault in the morning, the internet becomes a joy again, because you can just go from site to site to site and not have to manually key your passwords.
For the meanwhile, just sum up what you...
Can I ask this one more question, please?
Go on, Angela.
You know, I have backed up on my external hard drive. And now, if there has been some infection on the laptop, I presume that would have been gone onto the external hard drive with the files I backed up onto it.
Yeah, possibly.
I have to calm that now, or can I just wipe it clean? Or?
I would do a full scan of the drive itself and see if you can find anything. And then I would just... I'd try and back up the backup somewhere else and then make another backup. The thing is also, Angela, you have to have... an up-to-date backup of your system, and then you have to disconnect that from the computer, because there's certain types of infection called ransomware, where they encrypt, i.e. encode, all of your files on your computer and any files attached to your computer on a backup file.
That's why I back up on an external hard drive, which I can block and, you know, plug in and then take it out again.
Exactly. Well, Angela, I think you're halfway there. I think you've probably... learned a lesson with respect to letting other people access your computer remotely, but you've already taken some of the right steps to mitigating it.
Yeah, good luck with that, Angela. 0500 909 693, if you've got questions for Fevzi about your gadget dilemmas, then do give us a call.
This is BBC Five Live, available on the BBC iPlayer radio app. Up all night with Dotton Adebayo.
Our gadget detective is with us this morning for another 23 minutes. If you've got questions for him about your techie woes, I'm sure he can answer them. Andy in London, we'll come to you in just a second. Just a couple people here have been waiting to get their texts and emails answered, Fevzi. Well, quite a few people, actually. Let's start with this from Lizzie, who says, please, can you tell me how to compress high-quality photos so that they can easily be sent as attachments to emails? Idiot-proof instructions, please.
Okay, so an uncompressed photo might, for example, be a TIFF file. There are others as well. The common way of compressing photos is to use use a file format called JPEG. So you convert your uncompressed photo into a compressed photo, which is, as I say, typically JPEG. Within JPEG, so that's a file that ends with the letters .jpg. And within the standard of JPEG, there are different levels of compression. So sometimes that can be done on the fly. So if you need to email a photograph, say in Microsoft Outlook, there will be a setting that says send the attached photos uncompressed or compress them, and there might be, say, three levels of compression that you can choose from. Or you can use a third-party program that will allow you to control the level of compression again. But that would be the way to do it. A lot of cameras will shoot two versions of the same picture every time, or save two files for each photo. So you should look, if you've got a good camera, it may offer you to save you one as .raw, a raw file, which means it's the uncompressed data taken straight off the sensor of the camera, unadulterated, full quality. And at the same time, it may save to your memory card another file called a JPEG file. So the same picture, two versions, one high quality version for you to keep and edit and crop, and, you know, that's the one that you would manipulate, and another version for you to share, which would be a JPEG version.
Richard in Bolton says, why do atmospheric conditions affect TV signal reception on my Freeview box?
Well, although Freeview is digital, it's still, the digital signal is still encoded into an analog wave. That's why it can still be picked up by a standard aerial. So you'll have an electromagnetic wave going through the air, and it's subject to exactly the same sort of issues as before. So at night time, if there's clouds, you may find that that TV wave can bounce off the cloud layer, and you can get ghosting, or you can pick up a station that you can't get during the day. It's also subject to interference interference or being blocked by buildings or hills or other sources of electromagnetic waves. So the fact it's digital doesn't changes the sort of noise you get on the screen, but the fact that you do get interference and obstruction doesn't really change because it's still electromagnetic.
And Gary in Nottingham says updated last week. I mean, a lot of people have this problem. I certainly do. Updated last week. Now cannot use Safari like before on my iPhone. Help.
Yeah, so this is the brand new version of what was called Mac OS X, Sierra. It's now called Mac OS. Sierra, like with all operating systems, be it on Windows or Mac OS or iOS or Android, whenever there's a brand new big release, I'm not talking about the sort of small point releases of 10.1 or something like that. Whenever there is a big release, my advice to you is not to download it straight away because it will have bugs in it, and some of them will be quite big bugs, and it doesn't matter how much testing they've done. Software and operating systems are very complicated. The only people that really should be downloading the new versions of these softwares are tech journalists that need to test them. No one else really needs to do it unless you're a geek and you've got a spare machine and you just want to play with it.
I wish this phone-in was last night. Yeah. Anyway, let me just
I'm sorry, they do make it too easy to upgrade, in my opinion. An upgrade of an operating system to a major new version should not be done lightly, and it should be preceded by a full backup that you can restore to if it all goes pear-shaped. I just did it myself within hours of it becoming available on the Mac. Actually, I haven't had problems, but other people have had, and that's the problem, because so many users have a problem. You may find the operating system is fine for 98% of users, but for that remaining 2%, they can have potentially catastrophic issues. So rather than be the guinea pig, wait for other people, wait for the journalists and everyone else to report them.
I will do next time. Bugs. Andy, good morning.
Yeah, morning, Don. Morning, Fezzy.
Morning, Andy.
Hi. Right, you may have seen this problem on your site today, but I use a Mac with Google Chrome.
Yep.
Now, something has infected my Google Chrome, and I've tried to get... I looked for instructions, and they all looked rather dodgy. It did say, delete the applications folder. So I tried that, and it didn't work. So I got rid of the Chrome, and I'm now using Firefox.
Yep.
But I want to go back to using Chrome.
Well, you can go back, Andy, you can go back to using Chrome. And by the way, this is the most important reason why everyone should have at least two browsers installed on any computer that they use, be it Chrome, Firefox, Edge, what have you. The reason is when one gets broken, you need another browser to fix it. So if you wanted to put Chrome back, you need scan and download antivirus and so forth, you need a working browser. So where Chrome has become a problem, you've done the right thing, you've uninstalled Chrome. I would use the Mac version of CCleaner to have a clean up around it to make sure that any remnants that are left behind are safely removed. That's a third-party app. There's a free version. Don't pay for the paid-for version. You don't need it. And then I would download the latest version of Chrome from Google's own website. So
can I stop you there?
Sure.
Because I did exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to fix it. I couldn't fix it. I deleted it. I went straight to Google Chrome, or straight to Google, downloaded the latest version. It downloaded, I installed it, and it came up with this footy base, whatever it was on it. And I thought, oh no, like, it can't have come with that on it. It must be still on my machine.
Yeah.
So I uninstalled it. I C-cleaned it to, like, within an inch of its life. Like, 35 times right over, about three times.
Yeah.
And
okay, well, luckily, C-cleaner is mild.
I go back and, like, download it again.
Mm. Tell me a little bit, Andy, about the message that you're getting on the screen that leads you to believe you've got a problem.
Well, it's a lot... When you go into, say, you're on eBay...
Yeah.
There'll be the highlighted comments on the end of the remarks, and you put your cursor over it, and like a big advert will spring up.
Yeah.
And I can't remember exactly what it was, but
is
like
it,
Definitely not right.
Andy, is it always on the same sites? I mean, is it reproducible on those particular sites? And I'm sure it's not just eBay. I'm sure it may apply to other sites.
I can't really remember. Another thing as well, the homepage changed as well. Google Chrome,
It's hijacked.
Like graphic.
Okay.
So this is just a straight Google with like a couple of adverts on it.
Yeah. Okay. So
they vary from time to time.
And it
says footy base on it.
Right. There's a couple of possibilities here. The most likely possibility is that there remains an infection on the system which is still active, so that even when it comes across a fresh copy of Chrome, it can reinfect that version of Chrome.
Well, that sounds like it.
Although you've taken it directly from Google, and therefore it's not likely to have an infection in the downloaded code, it seems that the it didn't get removed with the Chrome, which is, you know, quite understandable. That does sometimes happen. So with that, what you need to do is you need to do a bit of research. You called it footy base, did you?
Yeah.
So Google is our friend here. What you should do is search for the exact wording in quotation marks in Google to see if you can find either instructions or removal tool to specifically remove the infection that you think you've got. And the way that you try and learn what infection you have is by the messages it gives you, and you quote them verbatim into a search engine such as Google or Bing or whichever one you prefer, and then try and do that. Before you follow any instructions, see if you can find the same advice on different websites, and make sure that you know, ideally try and do it manually rather than downloading a tool, because again, when you download a third-party tool, you know, particularly from a site that you're not familiar with, you could be downloading something else which is itself infected. It's because people get desperate to get rid of things, and in that desperation they let their guard down. So you need to be a little bit careful with that, but essentially you need to identify what it is and remove it. The only other thing I would mention to you, Andy, is that sometimes some of these things pop up not because you've got an infection on your machine, but because the little programs inside websites that make those animated adverts can themselves be carrying malware. That malware could either infect your machine or could just cause bad behavior on the system at that moment, even without infecting the machine. But I would work on the principle that it's likely to be an infection that remains on your machine. Try and identify it by doing some research. Try and find the removal instructions for that particular infection, and try to go at it that way. I would also at this point do a full system backup, in the knowledge that the backup may also contain an infection, but just in case things go from bad to worse, and you may need to, you know, recover your files from that backup. Even if it has an infection on it, you might still be able to recover files, because sometimes if there's one infection on the system, it can open the door to others, which could, as we mentioned earlier, could, for example, encrypt all your data for you and seek to ransom it back. So if you haven't got a current backup, I'd make one straight away and then disconnect it, keep it separate, just in case things go wrong from this point. I hope that they won't, but just in case they do.
Yeah, Angie, thank you. We've got LB with us in California, in Alhambra, of all places. LB, good morning.
Good morning, Dotton. Good morning, Mr. Tech Guy.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me on. Good morning. Thank you for having me on your show. I had a question regarding SD card on an Android phone. About a couple months back, I installed a larger SD card on my Android phone, and about a month or so afterwards, I noticed that the phone was telling me that it was unmounting the SD card,
yep.
Sometimes remounting it, but sometimes I would have to go back into the settings to mount it myself, and I'm just wondering what would cause that issue.
Sure. LB, what's the capacity of the SD card, please?
I went from 32 to 64, and it can take a lot more than that.
Okay. So the thing to be aware of is that although SD cards look pretty much all the same, there's SD and micro SD, but the SD cards look the same, but they're actually three different standards. There's the older standard, which is SD, and then which I think went up to about 2 gigabytes, I think, or possibly 4, and then there was SDHC, which went up to 32 gigabytes, and then SDXC, which is anything above 32 gigabytes. Now, what might be happening if you've got a 64 gigabyte card, that therefore is by definition an SDXC card, it may be that your device isn't fully compatible with SDXC. It may work after a fashion, but it may not be working reliably. So it's interesting that it's 64 because that's the next step up from the 32, which could have been dealt with an SDHC. So if, for example, you've got some 32 gig or less SD cards and they work fine, and the only one that's not working fine is the 64 gig, I would go back to the manual or look up the manual online for the particular device that you're using and see what it says in the manual. Sometimes the manuals are not very helpful because they may be an old manual where higher capacity cards may not even have been available. So it may say up to 32 gigabytes, but it may be because at that time, you know, anything above that wasn't common. So sometimes you need to go to the manufacturer's website and just check what is the compatibility. It will either say up to a certain capacity, or it will mention SDHC but not SDXC. If it does that, then there is your problem.
Right, I'll give it a go.
Okay.
Well, B, thank you. Really appreciate the call. Thanks for calling all the way from sunny California. This one's from San Gabriel Valley in LA, from Albi. I'd like to know why my 2-year-old Android mobile just started to unseat the SD card when it feels like it typically when it boots on. I then have been going into settings to reseat the card and all is well for a while, but then not. And by the way, paella is pronounced paella. I know. I heard that.
Well, that's a very similar question to the one that we've just had. So LB was talking about it unmounting. Was it RB now is talking about being unseated. Normally, when one talks about unseating, we're normally referring to something physically getting loose, you know. But if it's physically getting loose, then obviously there's a problem with either the card or the mechanism. But I suspect we're talking about the card becoming unmounted from the system, i.e. the system no longer recognizes the card, and I would refer RB to the answer I gave to LB. I mean, you need to check that the cards that you're using are actually compatible. Just because they physically fit doesn't mean they're compatible. You have to look to see if your device is SDXC compatible if you're using a card that's over 32 gigabytes in capacity.
Look, we made fun of Alexa, but one of our listeners has pointed out, this is Mark in Northamptonshire, it could be the new ultimate assistant for people who are visually impaired and those who can't move, etc.
And also the terminally lazy.
Thank you for including me in this. which is cheapest pay as you go, or which is the cheapest pay as you go internet? He says.
Oh well, that changes all the time. I mean, there are bundles. If you look at, there's websites that deal with this, such as Money Saving Expert. They keep up to date data on this. Also a website called Hot UK Deals, that you get people that out of the goodness of their own heart update spreadsheets on this very issue, but it literally changes from day to day.
Okay.
I would start with this: which network will give you the best reception in the areas where you most commonly need to use it? Because there's no point having, like, so for example, you know, you might see a really good deal with one network, you sign up for the contract, or you get the pay-as-you-go SIM, you get it home or in your office, and you've got no signal. And you can do all the homework you like. You can check their map to show you what the coverage will be at your postcode and your address. You can even check Ofcom's map. And I had an example not long ago where I signed up for a contract. I was told 4 or 5 bars of signal, but actually in practice I was getting 0 to 1 bar of signal. The maps are not always accurate.
Well, you should move to the city like the rest of us.
I was in London, and it wasn't just in the one area either. So, in fact, interestingly enough, Ofcom, last week announced that it produced an app for Android, which they're trying to do crowdsourcing of signals. So they want people to install the app on their Android device so that the app can notice what the signal strength is on that network in a particular location and feed that back to Ofcom. So Ofcom can have real data to share with others when they're trying to work out whether they'd like to get good signal or not. So to come back to the question, that's the thing you have to look at first, because it's no point having a really good deal if it doesn't work when you put it in your phone and fire it up.
Let me bring Alan in Wakefield into the conversation. You wanted to ask about Alexa, Alan?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Well, I heard what you were saying about Alexa, and I'm blind, and it sounds something which would be very useful to me. I wondered if you had any more comments to make. Is it something that I would be able to use? It sounded as though I didn't need even to feel my way around it or anything. Just
no, I mean, it stays, you can leave it plugged in and switched on all the time.
Yes.
And it will only respond when you say the word Alexa first, although you
so
can.
So does it recognise my voice, or does it...
Yes,
just...
you don't need to train it. It recognises... So it's designed for example, a family, where so it will recognise the voice of different family members. It's quite smart in that way. It has some additional potential functionality, which I didn't allude to, that may be of interest to you. It can also do home automation. So if you use, for example, if you've got a Hive internet connected thermostat for your heating, you can control that by voice with Alexa.
All right.
Don't forget, you can also do a lot of this on a smartphone. So if you already own a smartphone...
I don't use a smartphone, but simply because I'm blind and I can't. I have a mobile phone, but it's one that's made for blind people. It's not a smartphone. It's just a basic mobile phone.
I understand. Do you have internet at home?
Yes.
You do?
I use the computer with software which adapts it for blind people.
Is that JAWS?
No.
Use a different one.
This is a new one, but this is a guide. This is Dolphin Guide.
Okay. All right. I've heard of that. I've not used it. So... For Alexa to work, you need to have Wi-Fi, okay?
I've got Wi-Fi.
And it's pretty good. Now, Alexa was launched in the States just under 2 years ago, and although it's the same hardware that's come here now, almost 2 years later, it's a lot smarter than it was. So another possible function is that you can ask it to add things to your shopping list. You will in the future. You can't quite do it yet, but you can buy things from Amazon. You'll be able to have food delivered to your home. And it will give you voice feedback. And interestingly enough, one of the weaknesses I think Alexa has, which probably wouldn't affect you in the same way, is that Alexa is purely audio. So you can't tell it to fire up a film on your TV.
Okay.
But for you, I guess that's not as big an issue. Yeah. So I think it's something that would be... useful in some ways. I think it would become more useful as time goes by. We're at the very beginning of a long path towards intelligent environments and intelligent devices, but they will definitely be heading in that direction. And the nice thing is that it will continue to get smarter as you own it, not because it's necessarily learning from you, but because it's learning as Amazon, you know, culls more data from all. Because bear in mind, when you speak, it sends a recording of everything you say after the word Alexa is sent to Amazon for analysis. Yeah, and they keep those recordings, and obviously they can use it either to, it depends on your point of view on these things, either to improve the product and or share with the NSA. I think, you know, in the past where we said, you know, mind what you say in front of the children, I would counsel mind what you say in front of Alexa or Siri or Google Assistant. I think, look, it could be great. My advice to you is you might want, this is £150, and there are a couple of issues with it. I mentioned that, you know, it can play music. By the way, if you're an Amazon Prime customer, it is more useful because you can play music from your Amazon Prime account. But equally, if you've got Spotify or whatever, it will play from there. Or if you buy audiobooks from Audible, then it will play those as well. So it's built into their ecosystem. But the thing I wanted to say to you, the Amazon Dot, which is out on the 20th of this month, has exactly the same smarts, but it doesn't have that that good quality, albeit mono speaker. So if you've got already a stereo with an auxiliary input or Bluetooth, or just, you know, something that will take a 3.5mm jack, you could buy more cheaply. And it has one other benefit. I found that sometimes if you turn the music up loud, it can't hear you anymore. But if you're using an external speaker, which is away from the microphones, I think that problem will go away.
Alan, thanks a lot for the call. What about this one? Fevzi, oh gosh, now I've lost it. Oh, it was a good one as well, actually. Now, it's from Colin in Armagh. You've got to be quick. My Samsung A3 mobile keeps disconnecting from my router at home every few seconds and going into 4G. My other devices don't do this. I've tried resetting the router, but to no avail. It's driving me mad. Thank you. Quickly.
Probably worth updating the software in the router and on the A3 device as well, and see if that will help stabilise the problem.
First for news and the best live sport. This is BBC Five Live.